from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, if you've ever wondered what it's like to be a spy, then Amaryllis Fox's new book will give you one heck of a window into that world. She's a former CIA officer who has written a memoir about her experiences working undercover for the agency. It's been described by those who've read a lot of books about the Central Intelligence Agency as one of the most revealing and detailed books about how officers do spycraft, which has also made the book controversial. Amaryllis Fox joins us after this news. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're joined now by Amaryllis Fox. She's a former CIA officer and author. Her new book is Life Undercover, Coming of Age in the CIA. Fox was recruited to join the Central Intelligence Agency when she was 21, where she says she worked to infiltrate nuclear arms deals and stop attacks on civilians in the Middle East, all while also raising a baby girl. Welcome to Forum, Amaryllis Fox.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
So you were recruited even before you actually went ahead at the age of 21 to apply to the CIA. When you were at Oxford as an undergrad, at that time you said no. But when they approached you again when you were this time at Georgetown, you said yes. Can you tell me why it appealed to you at that point?
Well, when I was first approached as an undergrad, I had just finished a gap year that I took after high school, living on the Tiber-Meuse border. And at that time, I was an aspiring baby journalist looking to cut my teeth telling stories about the refugee community that had fled the authoritarian regime across the border in Burma. And while I was living in the camps, I came to be good friends with a Burmese democracy dissident, a young man named Minzin, who had lived in hiding in an attic for several years following the massacre of peaceful protesters in 1988, and then had flown across the border and was living in hiding in the jungle, producing a democracy newspaper, the Irrawaddy, on old school mimeograph machines in this jungle hideout and distributing them in the camps and across the border back into Burma. And he was in the middle of planning 9999, which was going to be an uprising of the students, peaceful protest to mirror that had happened in 1988, with a hope that it would turn out differently and topple the military regime at the time. And his concern was that if students were massacred in the same way that they had been in 1988, that yet again there might be no journalist there to document it, and he wouldn't have the Tiananmen Square-style photograph to share with the world the struggle and suffering of the democracy movement in Burma. And so he was looking for a journalist who might go in and document any violence that happened. And I think we all remember being teenagers and feeling immortal. And I was definitely in that place in my life. I was 17, just about to be 18, and felt that any good fight was worth fighting, regardless of the risk. And so I volunteered. And at the time, it was very difficult to get into Burma because they had shut down tourist and student visas because they knew these protests were coming up. So you needed to have a business visa. And here I was, a kind of ragtag journalist volunteer on the border with no access to a business visa. So I called an old friend who I'd met at a democracy meeting in London, who worked for a Japanese investment bank that happened to invest in Burma. And by way of recompense, he was volunteering his documentary filmmaking skills to the Free Burma Movement. I called him collect from a payphone on the edge of the jungle in a little Thai town there, and asked if he might take a few weeks off work and fly to Thailand so that we could pretend to be married and get into Burma on his business visa in order to record these protests. And to his eternal credit, he did exactly that. And we went to Khao Son Road in Bangkok, where you can get forged anything pretty much, and got a forged marriage certificate, bought Bic pens that we could hide film in, and cut up our satchels so we could film while we were cycling. And we went in to Burma on the 1st of September of 99 with a view to being there to record any protests and any violence. And as it turned out, the protests never came about because the regime had gotten wind of them and arrested many of the leaders in advance. And so the pro-democracy activists who had sent us there asked that instead we interview Aung San Suu Kyi, who at the time was under house arrest. She had won the Nobel Peace Prize, but wasn't allowed anywhere other than her home and the NLD headquarters, National League for Democracy headquarters. And so we went to interview her, knowing that we would likely be detained as a result, but thought that if we could hide the film well enough, we'd be able to get it out. And we did just that. We spent a couple of hours with her, and though she's found herself in much more controversial waters lately. Yes. At that time, she was really a beacon of hope and democracy to my young mind, and it was pretty amazing to hear her words and then be detained as we walked out of the building just for speaking with her.
Yes.
And so when I got to Oxford, which was a few weeks later, I'd gone through this kind of baptism to the world where I understood for the first time how powerful one person's truth-telling could be to bring this kind of military regime to its knees and require them to detain people in order to stop her words being shared with the world. And that was really electrifying to me. And so when I was at Oxford, my law professor said, you know, I'd love you to go and have some drinks with some former students of mine at the Fuggle in Firkin, which is a pub in central Oxford. And I didn't really have any context other than that. But when I got there, they explained that they'd heard that I'd been detained in a foreign regime and grown up moving around a lot and had a good sense of the world beyond the kind of civilized tones of England was the way that they presented it in quite a condescending way, I felt. And did I want to do that kind of work for them? And they never specified exactly which flavor they were. You know, I'm not sure if they were GCHQ or MI5 or 6. But they didn't really strike me as very curious about the rest of the world, humble in their approach. And I said, you know, I really believe daylight is the best disinfectant. And I don't want to participate in this cloak and dagger stuff, and thanks for the pint.
Yes.
And I left, and I really thought that would be the last of my interaction with the intelligence world, to be honest. I wanted to continue on to a career in journalism and NGO work.
But between that time and the next time you were approached, 9/11 happened, and also the killing of Wall Street Journal reporter Daniel Pearl. Talk about the role they played in you actually saying yes once you were at Georgetown in the Foreign Service, getting a master's program there.
Well, I was in Washington, D.C. The week before I started my last year at Oxford on 9/11. And my two little sisters were at the Cathedral School, which was evacuated because it was unclear to everyone at the time whether the cathedral might be another target. And I remember being with my mother in the car on my way to pick up my two little baby sisters in their school uniforms. And it brought back the early trauma in childhood of losing one of my very best friends in third grade on the flight that went down over Lockerbie, Scotland.
Yes, Pan Am
103. She was the first person And she was the first person I knew who died. And she died along with her sister and her parents on their way home for Christmas. And it had been an overwhelming loss for me as a child. And on my way to pick up my sisters on that chaotic and traumatic day in September, all of that came flooding back to me. And I recalled my father's advice from back when Laura died. He had said to me, "You are going to be overwhelmed with fear unless you understand the forces that took her. When we understand the things we're afraid of, they become less scary." And he'd introduced me to the newspaper, you know, and that was absolutely cathartic and groundbreaking for me. And I began to read the newspaper as a child with great care because it felt as though the forces that were in print on the paper might at any point kind of jump out into my real world and steal another one of my friends. So I read with great care as a child. And when 9/11 happened, all of that came flooding back, and the need to understand these forces so as not to be overwhelmed by the fear was the only advice that I could hold on to in the middle of that. And then 4 months later, once I'd returned to Oxford, Danny Pearl, who was my great writing hero and the journalist that I most hoped to emulate because of his ability as an Israeli journalist to tell these very curious human stories about the Islamic world. I had so much respect for that pluralistic viewpoint. And when he was taken pursuing a story in Pakistan and ultimately lost his life, it was an incredibly jarring moment for me where mm-hmm. I felt like the world of dialogue and open storytelling that he represented was disappearing. And the only way that I knew how to process that fear was to try to understand these forces. And I began looking at historical data to see whether there were correlations that maybe wouldn't be expected but could be used to predict or to understand terror groups and terror attacks. And it turned out that there were. You know, there are data points as varied as the percentage beneath livable wage that a border guard gets paid, you know, and therefore the potential for graft, for corruption at border passages, all the way to the ratio of hookah bars to madrasas and how fast that ratio is changing because of what that represents about social change. And all of these things, based on the historical data, could be weighed differently from 0 to 1 and strung together to rank locations by how concerning they were.
Yes, and that essentially was your thesis, right, when you were in the Foreign Service Master's Program at Georgetown, which drew the attention of the CIA. Emeralds Fox, would it be safe to say then that your initial reason for going in was to understand terrorist groups and try to stop terror attacks from happening in the first place using sort of the traditional means of the CIA? And you learned some really incredible things in terms of just how to do that in terms of spycraft, right? I mean, I remember reading about how you talked about you learned that one should carry Rolaids instead of chalk because it's less incriminating if you're captured or searched, or that if you want to communicate with an arms dealer who may be selling arms to terrorist groups, that you could set up an email account that you both shared and write messages through the drafts folder so that none of those things, there would be no record of actual emails being sent. And all that was really interesting. But I think what I also found interesting in reading your book was that your initial reason for going in changed as you started to engage with terrorists or people who were aiding terrorists.
That's absolutely true. I mean, that's the journey that's really at the heart of this book and the reason why a decade after leaving, I felt it was important to tell this story now. You know, all of those tradecraft details that you mention are are really anachronistic now. I mean, in many ways, I was kind of the last generation of the old school Cold War kind of trade craft, you know, where we weren't really even allowed to deal with cell phones and the internet in training. This was really old school spy craft that is outdated today in a world of facial recognition and biometrics. And I certainly don't envy my sisters and brothers who do this work now, because the tradecraft has necessarily had to evolve in a major way to deal with those threats. But more than those details, what I wanted to share was the evolution of my viewpoint on conflict that was informed by interaction after interaction with the adversary in many different forms. Because when I began, you know, it wasn't with a view to peacemaking in any capacity other than just wiping the adversary off the map. Mm-hmm. I'd suffered these personal losses that I mentioned, and I really came to the organization as a young person with the feeling that the way forward was to win a decisive military defeat against these groups and destroy their leaders and their capacity to operate. And over the course of many, many interactions, found that it's not that simple. You know, not only is that not a very fulfilling way to live, but more importantly, it often doesn't work. You know, we risk creating more adversaries than we destroy and adding to the Hydra's heads. And that's something that we see now with more splinter groups that are more dispersed and harder to tackle than ever before. And so in the course of my journey, what I found is that trying to identify the motivations that drive these abhorrent acts of violence and figure out what it is that might make them stop sounds very simple, but that act of deep listening is something that often we can forget when we just try to crush and destroy. And I think that today in our domestic life here at home, I'm really seeing some of those same symptoms, where it used to be that we had a hard time listening to the motivations of our adversaries in a brutal war overseas. And now today, it seems as though we're even having a hard time listening to the experiences and motivations of our adversaries across the aisle or across the Thanksgiving dinner table here in our domestic conversation at home. And that was really why I thought it was useful to share this journey, because I think that out of all of the threats that I have seen against this country in the time that I've worked in national security, the one that scares me the most today is actually the divisions that are weakening our house from the inside out. Because all of the terror threats and our geopolitical adversaries and rogue states, they all still exist. But we have the strongest military and intelligence infrastructure in the world to predict and prevent and respond to those kinds of attacks. But however great our military and intelligence structure is, it can't save us from our own divisions internally. And that is something that has not gone unnoticed by our adversaries, who realize that they're outgunned on the battlefield and therefore have shrewdly turned to fueling either side of every wedge issue in this country. And as
you're
a
alluding
result,
to, forgive me, Russian interference in our 2016 election, for example.
For example, and that's a very prevalent example, but we've also seen non-state actors, ISIS and others, fuel many sides of different debates in order to create the alienation and humiliation and feelings of not being heard that really cultivate their recruitment base. You know, these tactics are incredibly cheap and incredibly effective. And when I see many of the, you know, cable news conversations where, you know, they're not much more sophisticated than a middle school lunchroom fight at times on both sides, you know, I worry that we are playing directly into our adversary's hands and forgetting that it wasn't any particular issue that they thought could bring us down. It was our capacity to divide ourselves so destructively on every issue. And, you know, I remember back after 9/11, we used to say things like, you know, you have to go about your daily life because if you live in fear, the terrorists have won. And I think what we don't realize today is that we have to find common ground as Americans, because if we continue along this road of division, the Russians have won. The adversaries have won. This is a strategy that was very intentionally executed. And as gratifying as it can feel sometimes to retreat into your respective corners and surround, you know, ourselves with the people who agree with us, that is exactly the strategy that will divide us beyond beyond repair. And I really fear that the, you know, a house divided cannot stand caution from Lincoln is one that should be front and center again for us today.
We're talking with former CIA officer and peace activist Amaryllis Fox. Her memoir is about her experiences working undercover for the CIA, and it's called Life Undercover, Coming of Age in the CIA. Yes, there's this interesting line in your book when you're talking with a gentleman who has worked with folks who will resort to violence. And he says, humiliation is a powerful thing. Weapons are a stand-in for respect. And in some ways, what you do is you turn that around, and understanding that, appeal to somebody who is an arms dealer and address their sense of humiliation they felt at the way their ancestors or their grandfather was treated, but then turn that around to say, I see that truth in you, and I see that what you're trying to do is make that right, and here's one way to make that right. And that's how you actually end up recruiting this arms dealer to work on your side. I want to invite our listeners to join this conversation. We're talking with Amaryllis Fox. She has talked about not only her work for the CIA, but also just what it is like to live this dual identity undercover and be a parent, a spouse, and see around her what feels like not just division by boundary and religion and nation, but also even the divisions within our own country. You can give us a call at 866-733-6786 with your questions for Amaryllis Fox. You can also post them on Facebook, Twitter, and you can tweet us at KQED Forum, post them on our website, or email us at forum@kqed.org. And Amaryllis Fox, you know, just before we go into the break, just remind me again how unusual it is that you were recruited at that age, or is that the point, to get folks when they're young?
Oh, I think we often forget that young people are the backbone of our national security. I joined quite early, but really it's young men and women, often young women, on the front lines who are doing this work every day.
Yep. Well, we'll have more after the break. Stay with us. You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim, and we're joined now by Amaryllis Fox. She's a former CIA officer and author. Her new memoir, Life Undercover, Coming of Age in the CIA, talks about being recruited to join the Central Intelligence Agency when she was 21. And she worked to infiltrate nuclear arms deals and stop attacks on civilians in the Middle East, all while also raising her daughter. And if you'd like to ask Amaryllis Fox questions about her experiences and her thoughts on where we are now, give us a call at 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. Post your comments on Facebook, Twitter, our website, or email us at forum@kqed.org. There's another account in your book, Amaryllis Fox, where you talk about, again, rather than trying to basically destroy terrorists or take them off the face of this earth, that it was important to see their humanity, to try to get to peace. And one of these instances is when you are able to help stop an attack that's being planned by engaging one of the leaders of an organization that is planning this and recognizing that he had a daughter and that his daughter was struggling with asthma similar to yours, and you suggested clove oil as a way to help his child. And in that way, you were able to connect, not on the level of sides, you know, bad guy and good woman, but more like just trying to appeal to each other's shared role as parents. Now, this account has been challenged in terms of its veracity. It sounds sort of unrealistic that you could talk down an extremist with clove oil. Did this really happen?
There are operational details that have to be omitted from any account like this, and that is the case in each of the operational scenes here. But the interactions that are shared were real interactions. And this one is a particularly powerful one in that I think we often forget that alongside being an intelligence officer or a fighter on the other side, the people on both sides of this conflict have many other dimensions to their lives. You know, they get frustrated by traffic. They worry about their kids' health. You know, they are regular, banal human beings in many senses. And there's actually a story that I think is particularly instructive in that, where a journalist found in a market in Kabul a hard drive that turned out to have belonged to Zawahiri, the number two at the time in al-Qaeda. And before he turned it over to the government, he mirrored it, and some of the emails were printed in The Atlantic. They're pretty fun to read. But one of the things that's striking about them, as coming from the, you know, one of the world's most feared terrorists, is that in many ways they read as though they could have been written, you know, as part of an episode of The Office, right? They're like, thank you for submitting your expense report, or should I say cursory or a summary expense report, because no serious person would submit this as a complete expense report, you know, or thank you for your receipts around the fax machine. I think you misunderstood that you were authorized to repair, not replace the fax machine. There's another one saying, please leave the guest house in better order the next time you come through. We've had some complaints from other fighters. And these are really instructive in that they remind us that the people on all sides of this fight are in many senses just regular people and driven by the same complex set of human experiences and motivations as anyone else. And that opens up the possibility in conversations to be able to set aside for a moment one area of disagreement and connect on another. And I think, you know, we see this in our contemporary life, where it is a peculiarity of the human condition, I guess, to be very tempted to continue to dig your heels in when you get into a disagreement, you know, whether that's because of pride or inertia. The instinct to dig your heels in and pull this knot tighter and tighter and tighter when you're not getting anywhere. We've all had that experience. But what can happen when you take that hat off and find some other shared hat to put on for a minute is not that the disagreement goes away, but that you can return to it with a little bit of mutual respect. Mm. And often find it that knot slightly loosened and maybe some sliver of a path forward. And this goes back to what you were saying earlier about the power of humiliation and shame in driving this violence. It's something that I think we often underestimate. I actually just saw Joker, the film, last week and found it to be in many places a very disturbing but accurate and important portrayal of what alienation can do to drive violence, both here at home and overseas. There's a scene where he says, "You know, no one's been listening to me. No one's heard me, but now people are starting to listen." You know, after he began to engage in violence, and that yearning to be heard, to exist, to be acknowledged,
to matter,
To matter, right, is really, when you boil it down, almost comes down to the fear of mortality that is at the base of almost every human anxiety, right? Is, was I even here? Do I even matter? And when those feelings overcome people, we see, especially young people, really, really vulnerable to recruitment, both on the Islamic extremist front, but also with the rise of far-right extremism and many other flavors. And we saw it with A.Q. Khan. You know, it's a very dramatic example, but A.Q. Khan, who was the leader of a network that was really the most responsible for unchecked nuclear proliferation among rogue states and even non-state actors over the last few decades. This is what he cites as his backstory, and his inciting incident was being a teenager on a train traveling to Pakistan after it was newly separated from India, and an Indian border guard stealing his favorite fountain pen that he had saved up his pocket money as a teenager to buy. And he said, "You can't do that." And the guard said, "What are you going to do to stop me?" And he said that in that moment, he was determined that he and Pakistan would never be in a position where they were powerless in the face of disrespect again. And as a result of that tiny, insignificant interaction, he, from his teenage mind, felt that was such an insult that he went on to become the father of the Islamic bomb. He called it the Pakistani nuclear program, that is one of the most dangerous issues in our geopolitics today.
Yes,
over and in order to fuel it. Mm-hmm. All over a pen, exactly. And I think we forget how these small choices that we make in whether or not we hear one another out, whether or not we treat one another with dignity, even when we vehemently disagree, can have enormous follow-on effects in terms of violence in the future.
Well, I want to give our listeners a chance to comment and ask you questions. And we have a call from John in San Francisco. Hi, John. Join us.
Good morning. Hi, John. Great program, long overdue. I was a teenager recruited by the CIA after my tour in the Marine Corps, and I did their bidding for 2 years and discovered that nothing changes by killing your enemy. Nothing changes. Nothing changed in Vietnam except that a lot of my friends got killed. And when I left, I met some of the men that I was sent to kill. I met them, you know, and talked to them, and did not do the deed because of their integrity and my integrity. And now, you know, I'm an older man now, and I realize that all the killing in the world is not going to stop an idea. So, you know, we need to go back to the very beginning of this country. You know, when our founding fathers told us, you know, what was the best way to keep a democracy intact? It's not just by killing your enemy, but by having the strongest ideas and morals and integrity.
Well, John, thank you. I bet you have some incredible stories. Amaryllis Fox, is that valued at the CIA? You know, not killing your enemy, not using violence or resorting to violence, is what you described as your approach to try to kind of recruit and persuade to come to your side or to work with you. Did you feel like that was valued while you were there? Because you also describe a very macho environment where very few women were, especially doing non-official cover or undercover work as you were.
Well, I think as John demonstrates, you know, there were and are many courageous men and women who over the course of interactions allow themselves to to experience the humanity of the adversary, as scary as that can be at times. And I have found that the intelligence community and the military community is increasingly aware of the fact that violence cannot be prevented by violence alone. You know, God knows we humans have tried, and we Americans have tried in foreign policy over the last few decades. And I think that the caller, John, is absolutely right in that the city on the hill, the idea of the American experiment moving slowly at times, but ever towards a more perfect union, that idea, it does more to protect our national security than any Tomahawk missile ever could. You know, these combat theaters, even the most brutal, I've had the experience time and again of people who maybe are concerned about U.S. government policies, but love American culture, love American music and films and the idea of creative freedom, and yearn to live here, yearn to experience a free and pluralistic society. And I really do agree that that's our most powerful weapon of all, is continuing to nurture and cultivate that idea as a beacon of light. And one of the ways that I think we can do that is really investing in communities overseas, in terms of infrastructure projects and support for stability and growth long before the situation gets to a point where terror groups take hold, migrant crises create such instability, and we have to respond in some kind of military capacity. You know, we see China, one of our greatest geopolitical rivals right now, investing $1 trillion in this Belt and Road Initiative in 2/3 of the world's countries, building infrastructure and investing in countries that very well might turn to an alliance with the Chinese Friendship Zone over the United States if we don't remember that it's actually our soft power that has always been our most powerful weapon, and that an American flag on a brand new train or school, as China is doing, has a tremendously different impact than an American flag on shrapnel, even if the target was a legitimate one. And so I really do hope that as we move into a time where military footprints are necessarily going to be smaller anyway because of technological advances, that we think about using some of the underutilized resources, both personnel and money that we have in, available for our national defense, in building our soft power initiatives and really reclaiming that that idea of the city on the hill that will be there to collaborate on growth rather than come in too late and enforce through military and kinetic means.
Well,
and
Sarah,
I do think that that's an answer to your question. I do think that increasingly that is the view of many in national security, and I think that women in general have taken on a particularly powerful role in the intelligence world.
We have a female director of the CIA, Gina Haspel.
Exactly. And beneath Gina, the leaders of each of the directorates are also women for the first time in history. And, you know, there really are a set of skills that we tend to associate with sort of feminine approaches to problem solving that are critical for human intelligence. You know, being able to read a situation, emotional intelligence, multitasking, intuition, these are all the important arrows in an intelligence officer's quiver. And I'm so heartened to see women taking such a leadership role there.
Well, let
me ask
you,
I think it's really going to have an impact.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this question from Sarah, who says, bearing in mind the destructive effects of the Valerie Plame affair, and of course, the Valerie Plame affair was when a journalist outed Valerie Plame as a covert CIA officer in 2003. It was a political scandal then. And Sarah says, what are the prospects of someone contemplating a covert career in a world where carefully calculated intelligence work is endangered by random political food fights? I mean, is this a line of work you would recommend, Amaryllis Fox? Because also, in part, besides what Sarah is talking about, and we haven't quite gotten to this yet, you also write about just the incredible strain and the loneliness of being somebody with a dual identity, one where you essentially have to lie to family and friends.
I often say that the people who are least likely to find personal happiness in this kind of work are the people we most need doing it. And that can seem counterintuitive, but the work can be very lonely. Even more than that, there's immense moral complexity and a very heavy responsibility on your shoulders when you're engaged in this kind of work. And the people that we most need doing it are the ones who will feel that most acutely. And not enjoy it, not join for any sense of coolness or power trip, but because it is difficult and because it requires people who feel the weight of that to carry it out with the care that it deserves. I think part of that means that after as many years as somebody can bear it, they can leave and continue on in a different kind of service to their community and enjoy time with their family in a different period in their lives, knowing that they gave what they could. But it's a form of service that I really do encourage young people, and especially young women, young people of color, those who haven't seen themselves represented on the Hollywood screen as the type of person who joins the intelligence community. These are exactly the kind of people that we need and that I'm most encouraged to consider it. If it's not this, then maybe there's some other form of service. But I do really believe that each of us has a call to service that's unique to our experiences, unique to our skill sets, and that if we get very quiet, we can hear in our inner voice what that is. And maybe it's serving after a natural disaster, maybe it's volunteering at your local Y, but whatever it is will bring you closer to your community, will begin to bridge some of these divisions. Because I promise you, the one thing that it's not, when you get really quiet and listen and ask what your call to service is, the one thing it's not is yelling at the cable news TV screen. You know, there's a different way to serve, and it will help to build bridges in our community.
You mentioned seeing yourself on the screen. Your story is actually going to be developed into a TV series, as I understand it, starring Brie Larson, which you are an executive producer on. It is interesting also that you chose to become a mother while you were doing this, and your daughter was even sometimes part of your covert activity. And I found it striking that you talked about how, if at times you were judged for doing this kind of dangerous work as a parent or with your child, that you saw it in two ways, that not only were it was important for you to be the mom that was quiet and there and reading stories, but also the mom that was trying to deal with a wound in the world so that your child would not grow up with it. Do you still feel that way? Is that how you've been able to reconcile all of that?
I think that's the great question of every parent's life, right? You know, whether the stakes are the war on terror or the stakes are following your passion on behalf of your local community, modeling for our kids the things that we tell them, that as they grow up, it's their responsibility not to withdraw, but to roll up their sleeves and, you know, be a part of making the world that they wish they could see, you know, that each of us bears that responsibility. Those can't be empty words. I do believe that we need to model them for our kids. And the tension between being at home, as you say, reading Goodnight Moon under the warm covers every night, and being out making the world that our kids are going to inherit a safer place. That's, you know, that's a question that all of us struggle with every day. How do we do both? But I do think that motherhood, for me, really crystallized the stakes. You know, suddenly I was holding this one tiny embodiment, personification of everything that I hoped for our world, for our future. And in feeling that absolute unconditional love for this one little cub, I also felt the unconditional love that all of these other mothers on all sides of this conflict felt for their cubs, and the immense potential for loss on all sides. And that sisterhood really was a powerful motivator for me. Mm-hmm. Women are not only underrepresented in the waging of war, but most importantly, they're underrepresented in the resolving of war. And we know that when women are present at the negotiating table, as conflicts are brought to an end, that the peace deals that result last longer and with more success and more flourishing than when women do not participate. We see that at home in our own communities. When women step up as community leaders, we see less violence on the street. Female police officers have phenomenal impacts on communities compared to their male counterparts in many instances.
We're talking with Amaryllis Fox.
I was just going to say, encourage women to step up and explore those roles.
And Amaryllis Fox's memoir is called Life Undercover, Coming of Age in the CIA. She'll also be at the World Affairs Council on Wednesday, October 23rd, where we'll be talking again at 6:30. Let me bring John from Point Richmond into the conversation. Hi, John.
Hello. I was very glad to see you touch on some of the international investment that China is making, because as we've seen with the Panama Papers and what's going on in Washington right now, there's literally trillions of dollars unregulated sloshing back and forth. And this goes all the way back to Bretton Woods, where Keynes, the British economist, proposed the method which would stop these huge imbalances and money sloshing back and forth in pursuit of profits. And he predicted there were going to be huge corrupting effects of this, and also influence with negative influence on diplomacy. And I was wondering to what extent you saw that in your duties.
John, thanks.
That is a very insightful comment. The one thing that ties together all of the different networks that pose security challenges today, from, you know, terror groups through to these weapons and even narco networks, is the movement and transfer of illicit funds. And those networks, you can almost visualize them like spider webs, different colored spider webs, and all of them share nodes where money moves back and forth between human trafficking to terror groups to narco traffickers. And they also share nodes with the regular licit business world, where money moves back and forth from legal to illegal networks. And that is one of the greatest challenges for people working in security today. It's actually a challenge that I've just created a Netflix documentary series to document, that looks at the business interests and financial interests that that drive warfare. The first season of that documentary series, The Business of Drugs, looks at the movement of money and driving the war on drugs, and why the war on drugs, as it currently is being waged, will never work. That's called The Business of Drugs, and will be available on Netflix, I think, at the end of this year. So take a look at that, because it's a very in-depth exploration of this exact question. But it's really impossible to understand conflict today without understanding the impact of these massive amounts of illicit funds that move freely around the world.
John, thanks for the question. Corinne tweets, such thoughtfulness, critical thinking, and empathy for all sides is lacking in our leaders today. Would you ever consider running for public office? Amaryllis Fox, your book is really quite extraordinary, and I mentioned at the top that it was described as one of the most revealing books in terms of CIA operations, and especially as somebody in non-official cover. But then I learned that you actually did not get official clearance to publish from the CIA. Is that right? That was reported.
Oh, no. This is a long process, and at the very outset for me, I was given guidance really before putting pen to paper around which operational details had to be omitted and had to be changed, and that continued as we moved through the process, and some of that reporting was along the way. But it was a little bit easier, I think, for me because, unlike some of these other books that are blow-by-blow accounts of one particular operation, the bin Laden takedown or something like that, this really didn't set out to be a blow-by-blow description of a particular operation. It's much more an attempt to share my journey and evolution and the interactions that knocked these lessons into me year after year, against the backdrop of a personal journey of what it is to love and be a mother and raise a family in these kinds of environments.
So are you concerned that the CIA might come after you?
Oh, no, not at all. No, this was a process of great back and forth. And the only thing that was important to me was having omitted or changed those details, that it was noted up front on the first page so that the reader can come along with me arm in arm in the journey, knowing that some of those details had to be omitted.
Well, Amaryllis Fox, we really appreciate you talking with us today.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Her book is Life Undercover, Coming of Age in the CIA. And thanks to our listeners for their questions and comments. And from all of us at Forum, have a great weekend. I'm Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.